dreaming for me has been something that has not been very present in my life. I used to attribute that to my lifestyle, too much drinking, not enough sleep. But dreams were something that were just not present in my life. So today I'm talking with Gary Hone, who is a dream analyst as well as an author and a Taoist practitioner. And so as we look at the dreams and the dream states and the types of dreams today, we're looking at it through the lens of a Taoist. It's that middle path. It's understanding that everything is happening the way it's supposed to, the way that we're not manipulating life to happen, the way that we're being a guest in life and not trying to be the host of life. So today I'm really excited to talk with Carrie about her path, about her approach to dreams, about Taoism. I love Eastern philosophies, and this is something that has been very exciting to me and very pivotal in the path that I'm on. So I hope you get something out of the conversation. We'll see you on the other side. But first, a message from our sponsor. Our healing journey can be difficult and might feel lonely at times. That's why I love sound baths. When we can get together in a community, we intrinsically support and feel supported by others. And that combined energy can help us go deeper into our own healing journeys. And all you have to do is just lay there for 1 hour and listen to beautiful healing sounds. I'm a sound healing practitioner, and I hold sound baths on a regular basis in the greater Seattle area. You can find my next sound baths on my website at adamrealhealing.com. That's Adam, A-D-A-M, real, R-I-E-H-L, healing, H-E-A-L-I-N-G.com. AdamRealHealing.com. Your healing is worth your time. And now an uninterrupted podcast with Carrie Hone. All right, welcome back to our show. Today I'm joined by a lovely young lady named Carrie Hone. Carrie is the proprietor of a website called Cafe au Sol. And also a beautiful author. She contributes so much to Eastern philosophy, to understanding dreams, to understanding our path as humans. And I was introduced to Carrie's work through an external friend and started, you know, really digging into her work. And it's so funny because I can say this with the clients that I work with. The client that I work with that sits across from me that has something that I'm helping them through in some kind of way is generally something that I'm working through as well, right? It's that advice that I'm giving the person across from me that I should be taking myself. And I say that because as I was preparing for our interview, I you know, digging into your work, excuse me, and listening to some of the podcasts that you've done already and reading through some of the content that you've created. And, you know, I have ideas of Taoism, Buddhism, Confucianism, some of the Eastern philosophies and religions. And, but I've never really practiced one specifically, and reading and listening to your content on Taoism and following that middle path really reminded me a lot of, you know, how the extremes can move us to one way or the other, the elation of good or the elation of what we perceive as negative.
Right.
And so I had this moment today as I'm getting ready for our show and I'm getting ready for our interview. I get up by my Zoom and it won't update. It won't open. It won't update. It won't open. I can't uninstall it. And it's just one of those things of like, oh my God, computers, technology, what are you doing to me? Like Mercury retrograde, like what is going on right now? And then I've reminded myself of the, you know, so I just listened to a podcast you did yesterday and it was, and you hit that middle path and you started talking about that. And that concept came into my head as I'm sitting here behind my desk going through my anxiety of like, what the hell is going on with technology today? and that voice that your voice is just in the back of my head, that middle path. And I'm like, okay, take some breaths. This is the way it's supposed to be today. You know, this is the way it's supposed to happen. You're going to work through your stuff, you know, if you have to cancel, it'll be okay, but we'll probably find our way through it. And so just without even knowing you, you helped me.
Well, that's nice. It's very nice to meet you. And yeah, I really feel like life does often reach out and say, slow down, you know, be patient, you know, or, you know, look over here because you're focused in the wrong direction. Or so it's always like, you know, obviously I write a lot about the goodness of life. I really believe in that. I believe in the perfection of the way. And that's a lot of stuff we can jump into as we go.
Definitely. Definitely. So before we really get into the crux of your work and the awesome stuff that you do for humanity, kind of how did you get to the understanding of where you're at? You know, the different modalities that you work with and the different paths that you've kind of walked in life.
Well, I was blessed to have a mother who really like connected me to nature as a very young girl. You know, she used to bring animals in when they're having babies or say, you know, we were like everything was part of our family. And you know, when I was like asking maybe about religion, she gave me the book by James Michener called The Source, which is sort of a historical walk through like an archaeological dig over centuries. And you know, I was kind of always drawn to dreams. I always describe myself as sort of a poet. Like I just always saw sort of a more of a metaphorical. Like if you could think of life as, yeah, there's this reality that we're caught up in, and then there's this other side. And I just always seem to live in kind of a foot in both worlds. And so dreams always, you know, revealed the idea that we are guided in some way. And the challenge is, you know, who's guiding us? But who cares? We are guided. And you know, I mean, I've been doing it for decades. I'm like beyond like half a century, or you know, like I'm not a spring chicken anymore. But you know, it took a lot of ribbing from other people. Or you know, I remember going to a publisher in New York in the 90s maybe, and they're like, "You're writing about dreams? What? Where are you from?" "Oh, California." Woo, you know, like. And now, you know, today everybody recognizes that their dreams have some sort of relevance. And it was really kind of following them, working with people. And as you say, you know, a lot of my books, like a client will pop up and that will become the next chapter. You know, like it's that interactive, you know, learning through healing and then being healed yourself. And so I put the website together. I put the website together for people who want to explore their dreams. You can just type it in this cloud and it will give you all of the symbol interpretations. But what I found is that a lot of people don't remember their dreams, and that's another topic we can dig into or not later. But so I, you know, I, when you think of dream symbols and archetypes, and you know, you see these repetitive symbols across cultures, which is why I've translated a lot of ancient texts. You know, so I have like the Eastern version in the I Ching, which is an oracle, and then the Western version in Tarot, which really encapsulates a lot of our Western, you know, mythologies and ideas and approaches. You know, because what I found is when working with people, whether they would bring a dream in an I Ching reading or an oracle reading, and the information was identical. And I mean, I've done that so much that I'm very confident that if a person's not remembering their dream, and they come to one of the oracles, and if they have that same intention of really wanting to understand something that maybe they're missing, which is a lot for most of us. We're operating in such an unconscious, you know, realm. But you know, if they really want to kind of open to a new way or something, these oracles can be very powerful. So that kind of brings me to where I am.
That's beautiful. And I love that you're mixing, different modalities to kind of, find the best path to help the person out. I love that, we're in a area in the world now, or an area in time now, where information is readily shared, and that's both good and bad. We have a lot of misinformation out there, but the ability to gain information and to find ways to respect that information as it comes in, so we're not appropriating it, we're showing it the honor and the reverence that it needs. But the fact that not everything is one way, the Taoism way is a beautiful way to look at life, but there's also beautiful ways to look at life in, some of the Western indigenous ways, or, different religious type of texts. And having that ability to kind of find the ways that all these things mesh together in your beautiful life and the ways that it can help support, and now you can help support other people. I think that adds those layers that not everybody can see, but is unique to you, because that's the path that you're on to be able to find these little puzzle pieces and fit them together to help the human that's in front of you.
And so really, like I went through a lot of comparative, you know, history, religion, mythologies and all that. And in some of the books that I've written, The Mythology of Sleep looks at a mythology from all around the world as a way of understanding the hero's journey through the dreamscape. And you know, so in doing, the only reason that I really kind of used Taoism as sort of a platform, which a lot of people do, Wayne Dyer and Eckhart Tolle, a lot of people that in their writings are really founded on these principles of Taoism. Alan Watts is a great thinker. But what appealed to me was that it was they were really the only, I wouldn't call it a religion, because the ancient Taoists were more of a philosophical kind of, they're more of like the Plato and Aristotle and the Greeks of the 500, BC period, or 500, back when thinking about what how to describe life in ancient China. They were not like thinking that, they were looking at nature to understand the human journey. Like they were looking at how water could be a teacher, or how what a mountain really represents as an archetype, let's say, for steadfastness and weathering the, vicissitudes. Or so the nature aspect, kind of really appealed to me. And I also found that the principles are so simple, like you had brought up in the beginning of our discussion, the middle way. And I think one of the most profound things that I can teach somebody is to learn how the extremes just lead us in an emotional roller coaster of judgments and expectations and disappointments, and whatever it is. It is never good or bad, because eventually, if you think it's good, you'll see it could be bad, but the bad is really the good. And, so it's like, why classify? And that, simplicity of staying in the moment with the flow of what's unfolding is such a joyful way to live.
There's also something that you had mentioned in one of the talks I listened to, and it was something around being a guest of this world, and that was what I'd never heard, a concept put that way, and it's one of those things that immediately landed with me, to be a guest in this world, because so many times I find myself forcing myself into this world and forcing a path of like, I should have a career. I should have a 401k. I should have a retirement plan. And for a long time that felt right, but in the later life now, it doesn't really feel like I should be fitting myself into somebody else's box. And when I look at that, when I hear that concept of be the guest of this world, the guest of this, being a guest is like, how can I
Not
help?
there. Yeah, and also not being the host. You're the guest, not the host. And it's funny, because I just wrote a blog today about who's really in charge and the whole idea of, being the guest and not the host. And I mean, if we were supposed to be the host, we would have shown up here with instructions. We would have an ability to know the future, so that we could, completely orchestrate every step. And it isn't like that. We're here interacting with this tapestry of wonder, and whether you want to call it like natural selection and challenges and the things that bring, our capabilities to the fore. Another idea that I love, I don't know if you caught any of that stuff that I write about, how nature teaches us to be unique, or what it reveals, because if you imagine like billions of years ago, and the first life forms, they would have been like a bacterial type, thing. And it was just splitting itself in two, and then that would split itself in two. So it was binary fission, to where all offspring were an identical, and it's still, bacteria still does that today. They are a complete replication of what went before. And if we were created that way, we'd all be the same, but it took sexual reproduction. And not only the recombination of the DNA of our parents, but the fact that you have a combination of your dad and mom that's different from your siblings means that you're unique, even among your siblings. And at some level, nature devised siblings to be unique from each other because of the proximity for resources. It wants them to kind of spread out and go. And, so everything that nature reveals to us in its processes shows us that we're not supposed to be, acting like everyone else, or following what society deems should be, the correct way, to be. And, which is another reason I think for dreaming is like an evolutionary mechanism, because we are, we enter into the world and our peer pressure, everything is like demanding some of these instinctual things that we feel emotionally. This is really me. Why can't I be this? It gets shut down. Every night, without fail, we drift into a different relationship the mind has with life, let's say, and the part of us that's more authentic is given expression. And any ideas that inhibit our, you know, growth or the self-limiting ideas, they're explored in this, you know, dreamscape, and we are made more authentic. And authentic is another word for unique.
Definitely. You know, and I flagged your mythology of sleep book, because right now I'm reading a lot about sleep, and that it's just, I don't know, you know, subjects just kind of come into your purview and you start, you know, digging into them. And and so the book that I'm reading right now is called Why We Sleep. And it talks, you know, and that's why I saw your book, Mythology of Sleep, I'm like, cool, that's next up on the list. but one of the things it talks about, and I think you've talked about in some of the talks you have too, and or tap danced towards this idea, is that when we go to sleep and when we have those dreams, whether we realize them, we remember our dreams or not, a lot of times we're giving ourselves therapy in our own dreams, because we're putting ourselves in different scenarios around something that might have happened in our waking life, so that we can see the different perspectives on how to approach this scenario, so that when we get back into the world, we can be a little more prepared for, you know, that type of, maybe it's a trauma that we've experienced, or, you know, an embarrassing moment or something, you know? And so when we have these dreams, we put ourselves in these positions to where we can see that embarrassment or that misunderstanding from different perspectives, so that when we wake back up, we're a little more prepared for the different types of scenarios that can approach us. Does that sound like something that you've kind of seen in the dream work?
You know, dreams are what give us possibilities. You know, if we didn't, it's like kind of like if we didn't have the opportunity. Well, let me just explain something for your listeners who don't really know kind of. And again, please, nobody knows anything. So these are just theories, but these are pretty consensus. People kind of think of the mind as the right and the left brain. And the left brain is the language center, logic, everything that's associated with ego. And the right brain would be more creative, holistic. It's more emotionally driven. And I see dreaming as we spend the day in the left brain, you know, orchestrating everything. And then when we dream, we're more in the right brain. And it's kind of, so you can kind of think of it as more imaginative. So when we sleep, the body experiences a paralytic feature. I wouldn't say we're unconscious, but that that aspects of consciousness, like if you took if you're going to have surgery and you have like an anesthesiologist, you know, that makes you unconscious.
Right. Yeah.
But dreaming. Yeah. So dreaming, there's still like the brain waves and all that, but the parts of us that would think this can't be happening, that's too weird, because I love weird dreams. And we could talk about that too, because that's where the real key, that's where the message is in the weirdness of the dream. But you know, the sense of this can't be happening, I'm in charge, you know, all these things, you know, fall by the wayside. So if we didn't dream, we wouldn't evolve. We would be stuck in a mode that maybe a parent told us we should be, or what we bought into from peer pressure in school, what our current boss has convinced us that this is the only way, you know, to be able to be successful. You know, even spiritual people, I see this all the time. It's happened to me. Like when you're younger, you think, oh, I go through all these, you know, processes and meditations and yoga and whatever it is to become enlightened. Why am I in a grocery store arguing with the lady behind me? You know, like, how did that happen? Because we're never done growing. And another thing that I love about nature is it's balancing out extremes. We see it in the weather, hot and cold pressure systems, water temperatures, the El Nino to La Nina, you know, constant like balancing for optimal life on Earth. And wouldn't it make sense that somebody who is full of compassion might be brought together with somebody who's deficient in acceptance and whatever, that there might be some sort of need for both to share the energy of balance. Without judgment, like who knows what it was about, but we know that it was necessary.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no, you're good. That reminds me of a Ram Dass talk I heard a while back before he passed. And it was him talking about, I think it was a talk in the 70s, and he was talking about, you know, when he, you know, went from Richard Alpert to Ram Dass, right? And he, you know, was doing the speeches and holding space, going to India, and he, you know, thought he had to personify this Ram Dass person. And so with that, he thought that he had to be this holy kind of person. He couldn't show emotions in a negative, what we would perceive as a negative way. And he had to always be, you know, like happy and, you know, jovial and all this stuff. And what he was finding is he would be that person on stage, but as soon as he would leave the speech or the talk he was given, he would be just miserable. He would kind of lash out at the people mm-hmm. closest to him and just not feel balanced. And it wasn't until he finally realized that that's part of the process. Like, there is a balance. You're not always going to be this holy person, or you will always be that, but mm-hmm. you're going to have a range of emotions. Like, we're on a mm-hmm. spectrum of emotions for a reason. And I love the old Bell Hooks quote, like, all emotions are okay, but all behaviors are not. So when we can fully, like, hear the message of the emotion, and, you know, we're still discerning whether or not we step towards it, but we still hear, we take the time to hear the emotion, then we can experience that and get the knowledge from that and get the wisdom from that emotion, and not just think we have to be in this, you know, what we consider this higher light kind of atmosphere. We need to have that balance of, you know, what we consider maybe fear or the negative emotions to really kind of, you know, keep us understanding in that middle path that you talked about earlier.
Right. And I love Ram Dass too. I used to listen to him years ago, driving for miles, yeah. You know, like, I just think he was a brilliant, and, you know, but one thing I would say in that kind of scenario mm-hmm. is, you know, we only learn what we're capable of, like, a lot of times, because we're put in a position to help somebody else, you know, so I would call that channeling, mm-hmm. you know, or like you were describing working with a client, you know, you're learning. So I feel like he probably experienced a wellspring of inspiration coming through him as he opened himself up to, you know, be with people at a level of healing. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't necessarily mean that he as whatever his real name was. What did you say his name was?
Richard Alpert.
Yeah, Richard Alpert. You know, that he was really not also a student that would need to apply some of those principles. But yeah, you know, it's, if, you know, I just kind of went through a difficult situation. And I mean, I'm just very grateful. I'm sorry, but my mom just passed recently.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And, it, you know, I mean, I'm sorry too, but it was, you know, one of, like, a cycle of life. And, you know, she was not good in the end or whatever, but mm-hmm. I'm just grateful for the philosophy that prepared me, you know, that I can be okay with it. You know what I mean?
I do. Unfortunately, my mother just passed also in September.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Yeah. But, you know, but to your point you just made, at the point that I'm at in life now, my father passed away about 15 years ago, and I was not in a spiritual place. I wouldn't even say spiritual place. I didn't have any peaceful practices. I was drinking heavily, and I wasn't in a place to process it properly, you know, and that grief stuck around for a long time and plagued my life because I couldn't face it. And, you know, when my mom was diagnosed with cancer about a year before she passed. and you know, I was in a different place. You know, I was in a place to where I was finding myself. I was being able to sit with emotions, sit with sensations. And so to be present with my mom as she passed, and she, you know, that veil so thin, you know, as they're starting to pass, and to have conversations with her and to be a witness to her waking dreams, you know, mm-hmm. in a way of, you know, not that, you know, it's, she was so close to death for a few days that, you know, everything that she was saying was something that was so mystical or, you know, metaphoric. And it was beautiful to kind of witness her, almost like it's her dream state, you know, when she would be coherent for those moments. Mm-hmm. And there was so much beauty that came from that, and being able to ask questions and to, like you were saying, being, you know, listening to the poetry of what was being related back and listening mm-hmm. to it for those archetypal kind of ideas and for those philosophical ideas. And, you know, not trying to dig too much into it, like, what did you mean by dirty door, mom?
Yeah.
Just taking it for how it felt in me, you know, right. and just seeing how that meant and just how much has stuck around. It's been so beautiful to help me process that passing.
Well, it brings up an interesting point that I continue to explore and probably will until the day I die. But I am under the impression from all the work that I've done with, like, thousands upon thousands of people across the earth mm. since the internet, you know, I can, like, talk to people anywhere, you know, doing dream therapy to be able to see what they're dreaming, and also watching them go through a metamorphosis over whether it's 3 weeks or 2 months or a year, you know, so you see this sort of, you get a sense that the dreaming mind is more enlightened than the waking mind. The dreaming mind brings forth information that the waking mind is not privy to. You know, like there, I think it was one of Jung's students or something wrote something about the dreams know the dreamer better than they know themselves. Mm-hmm. And I believe that. And so, you know, you start to get a sense that, you know, again, in biblical works, they call it, you know, I think it was in the book of Job when he's arguing with everybody, you know, somebody says, you know, yeah, these visions of the night, you know, that's how God speaks to us, or, you know, whether you look at it there or you look in the Native American culture, you know, that we tested ourselves through our dreams. We couldn't really do anything without, like, they would talk about their dreams every day. And, you know, so the dream world, the information that's coming from there, whether it's the higher self, mm-hmm. the soul, God, the great spirit, I don't know, whatever it is, nature, maybe just an evolutionary, you know, download from a operating system we're not aware of.
Right.
We don't know what it is. Uh-huh. But it makes me wonder, because like what you experienced with your mom, and I worked a lot with the elderly in Los Angeles. You know, I did a lot of creative programs with them, helping them toward that next step. Hmm. And I saw a lot of the same. And I feel like, what if it's the dreaming mind that goes on? You know, like, you know what I mean? Like, of course, it doesn't make sense to us here,
right,
when everything is, you know, the little ego and all the survival mechanisms that keep us alive all day long. It wouldn't make much sense. But, you know, it's interesting to think about, I guess.
Yeah. There's a talk I heard a while back, and I can't remember which kind of lineage or which maybe denomination it was talking about. But the concept was really interesting to me. And it was the idea that when you pass away, you go on living your quote unquote normal life until you realize that you have passed away. Right. So if I, you know, pass away, have a heart attack, whatever it is, you know, I'm going to wake up in a dream state in my house with my kids next to my fiance, get up, make breakfast, read my book. And that can go on for as long as the habit is there for, right? I go to work, I punch mm-hmm. a clock, whatever it is. But eventually you start to realize that this isn't your life anymore, and that you are in this waking dream, and that you're able to kind of move out and do whatever you want in this world now, in that dream state world, because that is that next evolution of, you know, the psyche or whatever it is. So the thing that was really interesting to me with that is that it forces you still to be the witness of your path, right? Because you still, like, you pass away, but you wake back up in your normal life. And it's up to you to start to realize that the nuances of what we consider normal and how you can maneuver through that. And then eventually you find yourself like, oh shit, I'm in that next realm. Mm-hmm. There's no more barriers. There's no more walls. Everything's ethereal. And then you could start mm-hmm. to move around into that world, but it's up to you to find that.
Right. And, you know, another really great book I read, probably one of my favorites, it has a long title, but it was called The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. Have you ever heard of that book?
No, I haven't. No.
Okay. So it's written by Julian Jaynes. Okay. I mean, when I read it, it was probably 30 years ago. But, you know, it's only now kind of come into its own. But he thought that, and it kind of makes sense, like that the consciousness of the things that we read back from, like, the Epic of Gilgamesh or the, you know, Greek myths, or that the consciousness of the people that were writing at the time would have been as developed as a 3-year-old in our day and age, meaning to say that consciousness developed with language, because as words became concepts and concepts start to take the place of the actual experience or whatever, we became very much in our left brain. But prior to that, he gives a lot more focus to the right brain, which I believe is really the conduit to dreaming. And that is why when we wake up, we're more in a right brain orientation, very imagery and emotionally driven. And as we slip back into the left brain, whatever we were dreaming evaporates, because it's two different minds.
Yeah.
So I just thought he made an interesting case for the idea that the way we are is, you know, before we learn to speak, mm-hmm. we are in touch with kind of, you might call an ethereal or very highly inspirational soul level. I don't know, just, you know, boundless.
Yeah.
Similar to what we dream and what you might be referring to as the person, let's go of the restrictions that kept them thinking that they're alive. Or, I mean, obviously nobody knows like what happens. People have had experiences. I've had, some, but anyway.
Yeah. Well, with that kind of concept, in your experiences with dissecting dreams and helping people with that, do you feel like, okay, so as we wake up, we're more in that right brain creative side, but and we kind of shift more to the left brain side. So does that kind of that, to me, that leads to an idea that our ego is very left brain. It's very,
Exactly.
okay. And so as we get back
Yeah.
into this world where the ego needs to have, or
Well,
seems to need to have.
remember the side of the mind that repressed the information that we're dreaming about. We dream of what we're not facing. That's why a person maybe that's trying to forget a loved one or quit smoking, or you dream about it then, because whatever you're repressing by day, has expression in your dream life. So the side of the, like let's just say that, a kid is told that a certain type of behavior isn't acceptable, and they repress that, which becomes the shadow and dreams, a whole nother topic of discussion. But it's the side of us that we're repressing that we're dreaming about. So it's kind of like the side of the mind that's awake by day doesn't want to know that information. It's almost like it's if I was to say how many people remember their dreams, I would say probably 20%. And people that are working with me, and when they take a conscious, take conscious effort into whether it's just saying before they go to sleep, I want to remember my dream, whether it's remembering while they're waking up, don't wake up too fast. What's the image? Just one image from that dream can give you so much information. And as they write it down, and then it like blows their mind when they learn later, wow, that dream was really telling me how to get through this challenge that I'm facing right now. And now they seem to remember their dreams more. And then they'll go through a period where it's not necessary, to remember their dreams. They'll also people go through periods where they have nightmares, where their dreams get really, people trying to chase and kill them, or they, which is a very common dream of people that are, I call it the 20 something dream, because they're being forced into these different personas that they're not comfortable with. And the people chasing them are actually these sides of themselves trying to figure out, which one should live, because death in a dream is just letting some side of us, go.
Yeah.
So it's kind, so it would make sense that when we wake up, more often than not, we won't remember our dream. And there's no reason to, because the dream is still just like we don't need to know how our cells are replenishing themselves, or how, our heart is doing what it's doing, which ventricle did it just move through. We
Right.
don't need to know that, So we're still being healed through that, through this process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it feels like, I mean, you'd mentioned earlier about, when we dream, maybe we're, talking to our inner self, that deep self, that Atman, that, God, whatever, name you want to call it.
Oh,
And
I call it the big purple fish. No, I don't have a name for it.
Hey, if there's a big spaghetti monster in the sky, there can be a big purple fish,
Exactly.
right? But so and that makes sense, because if we constantly have the awareness of that Atman, that capital S self in our waking space, that's something we have to move towards, and if that's something that was always there, then maybe we wouldn't know to look deeper for something, and
Right.
to stop taking things at face value and try to see, some of the lessons that we can learn from either waking life or dreaming life. Yeah.
And it really kind of comes down to the idea that we're never done. We're never complete. We're never evolved, and come to a stop. So it's just, no matter where we are in life, we're going to continue. It's almost like, again, going back to the DNA and how we're made into. After billions of years, and we just showed up seconds ago, we are at this moment in time, each of us, the greatest example of what nature can do with what it has right now, everything. And I mean, this morning I was pulling into the driveway, and there was like a mother turkey and her little ones, and there was a little boy baby turkey with his little back feathers up. And she was like, he wouldn't move. I was trying to pull in the driveway, and I'm just like watching this little guy. And but no matter where you look, whether it's just those explosions of new bugs that just are out today and gone tomorrow, or everything is today is nature's best that it's capable of. And it doesn't mean that it looks like a picture of upward trajectory. A lot of times it goes through, like you see a hurricane, it has to blow through it to change the water temperatures and it feels bad, but the forest fires to reduce the amount of brush so that trees can thrive, or things that we wouldn't call good, but in nature's picture they're necessary. So that sense that there's always this, we're caught up in that trajectory.
Yeah, there's something I read about a while back, and it was talking about how one of the theory not theories, I mean, one of the ways to look at life is that we are nature's artificial intelligence. So as through evolution of humanity or evolution of nature, nature was like, you know what, we need a being that can build things. We need a being that can be bipedal, that can use tools, that can think on their own. So creating humanity to be the avatar, to be the artificial intelligence of nature, so that we can take and do what nature, things that nature can't do, but not necessarily because since we are part of nature, we're doing what nature wants us to do. So even in those spaces of, we're increasing global warming, we're, polluting the world, we're, doing all these things, these negative things that
And
humans.
we're not the only intelligence out there, for sure. Like,
Right,
there's a lot
right.
of other things doing great, a lot of other things that we would think don't have intelligence. Like, I believe a plant that's trying to reach the sun so it can get its food is every bit as conscious as, a deer trying to graze on the grass to eat food. Or, like, I don't think we see the big story, and I don't think humans are necessarily the apex
Exactly,
of
exactly.
its plan, but we
Totally. Yeah,
definitely
every and that's, to that point, like everything has its place, like the grass, the cow that's grazing on the grass, cuts that grass back to create more space so that more, beings can grow up in there, or that grass can grow back healthier. Its dung, creates fertilizer for more plants and other beings to be part of this world. And it's that cyclical nature, and I, to that point you just made, us thinking, humans thinking that we are the impact, the apex creators, the predators, all these things, these are all just those alpha, ideas. Those are just those concepts. These are concepts that have just been kind of, put out there, and,
But
some.
you're but I agree with you on the idea that we are a variation, that is able, but a lot of other, like, forces or fields or things that are just out there randomly in our universe. I mean, but we are a variation that's taking something and transforming it into something else, for sometimes for the good, and a lot of times for the bad. And I don't think that we'll ever destroy this planet. If anything, we'll just destroy ourselves, and this planet's been around for billions of years, and it will continue to do so, So
Yes.
it's like,
Yeah, we're making it stronger, if anything. We're that virus that, that keeps, making the planet get stronger and evolve in its own personal way that it has to.
Well, didn't you observe, like, I don't know if you felt this, and I've talked to other people who kind of, felt the same thing, but it did feel like the virus was a wake-up call.
I agree.
It went so fast, and it went worldwide, and we all got t sort of taken out of our routines and sort of had to learn how to be alone again, or, but it did sort of feel like, you guys, stop with the wars, or stop with it, like, we've got to get our act together. It's going to continue to give us those wake-up calls. I don't know.
No,
I mean, I'm definitely I'm I don't see anything as bad, but I definitely think a learning experience might be in order.
Yeah, no, I agree. There's actually studies that are out right now about how depression is linked to an overactive default mode network. That desire to have ritual, the desire for me is like, wake up at 7, make breakfast, have coffee, read a book for 2 hours, go teach yoga, do a podcast, so I have that lather, rinse, repeat kind of idea. And in a way, that makes me feel really grounded, because I know the flow of my day, right? I know what's going on. But the caveat to that is, if anything goes wrong with that, then that could spend me into a spiral, right? And it's like, oh, well, now I can't read. Now my yoga class is going to be shit because I didn't read for 2 hours, and this, that, and the other. And so if we can get ourselves out of that, I have to do X, Y, and Z to feel like a human, knowing that that stuff is there for you and that can feel good, but knowing that also we're surrounded by 8.5 billion people, and sometimes you're not going to be able to do everything you want to do. I'm a father of two children. I don't have a lot of alone time, right? So I don't really get a lot of that time. But so I think to your point that you know, the virus kind of took us out of that default mode network of, you know, get up, go to work, come home, do whatever, you know, lather, rinse, repeat, keep doing that again. And now it's like, shit, now we have time. You know, right. To the people, you know, for myself, I wasn't severely negatively affected either health-wise or monetary, you know. So my fiance and I were able to kind of develop a lot of beautiful personal habits and new trajectories in life through that shutting down of our default mode network for a little while and saying, hey, figure it out. You know, what else are you going to do?
Well, that, and it kind of goes back to what we were talking about originally, the idea of being the guest and not the host. Mm. You know, whatever it is that is like in charge, that is, you know, probably, I would venture to say, smarter than us, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's just nature and the processes or whatever. It seems like, even, you know, I mean, I hear you on wanting to have all these processes. It's a very human thing. In fact, we're called organisms. We love to organize, and we live in a world that's been defined as chaos, right? Entropy. Uh-huh. Like energy's coming here and it's floating away as entropy. And we're over here busy, like trying to make sense of it. And it gives us comfort. And it's, but we've been doing it forever. It's probably why burial started, right? Mm. Like to have like some sort of like way of dealing even with that.
Yeah.
That's beyond our control. But it just feels like, the idea of being present, and I hate to say that because that sounds so trite, and it can be, you know, it comes from so many different directions. But when I say be present, I mean like they're getting to that place where you don't judge good and bad. That if you can, like I call it hover at the doorway of perception, come to where your eyes are right before your nose starts, and stay there. Like, just stay there and observe and listen and watch and smile and watch if somebody smiles back. And, you know, like, don't, like, have an agenda. You couldn't be the master of your response, I say, you know, like, because if you can just be a witness, then you it's like you can't help but see the great mystery, the idea of wandering in the unfathomable, you know, like, there's something very freeing about not being in control, not needing to have an answer, finding questions as an opportunity for heightened creativity, you know, or an opportunity to learn, and just sort of like getting in that flow.
Yeah.
And I kind of picture it as a carriage. I call it the carriage ride. Like, it pulls up out front every day, new carriage, new ride, get in it. Doesn't matter how long you've been on this planet. If the ride is going to be different, and it can be wondrous when you can just sort of hover there.
Yeah. There is a beauty in that. Just that acceptance of being present, or, you know, being here, being a witness. I want to come back to dreaming one more time before we close this bracket. I wanted to get your input on lucid dreaming. You know, and I'm not a lucid dreamer, so I don't think I've said this yet, but for myself, dreams have been very, hit and miss for me. And so hearing you say earlier that not, you know, only 20% of people remember their dreams kind of gives me a breath of fresh air. You know, I used to drink a lot and, you know, heavily sedate myself quite a bit. And I think, you know, through that process, you know, I just kind of would pass out, you know, and then wake up and be like, oh, start the day. No, I have no idea what I did when I dreamt. Didn't even realize if I got good or bad sleep. I just closed my eyes and woke back up. And now, you know, now having put that beside me and moving more towards, you know, wanting to understand my dreams and wanting to realize if I have dreams or not, you know, like to your point, I was saying, you know, before I go to bed, I tell myself I want to be a conscious observer of my dream. You know, I want to witness my dream in some kind of way. And so now I'm starting to come back a little bit with some ideas of dreams. But I do have friends that are lucid dreamers. And I just wonder if that's like the next evolutionary path for dreams and for humanity.
I get asked that question a lot.
Awesome.
And I have an answer, and it's not necessarily right or wrong, right? Like, this is the way I understand dreaming from all of the decades that I've dedicated to researching and working with people. As they, you know, I watch them have the dream. They tell me about it. It makes no sense to them. But as we work through it, they, you know, they start to see that there's a message there. And then let's say it takes 2 weeks before it becomes maybe what would be synchronicity. That's like a a time when, wow, did I dream this? Or, and that really I see as initiation. It's like whatever was being worked through in the dreamscape, now that you have the opportunity to own it or discard it, you know? And so it takes like a few weeks, let's say, before what we're dreaming starts to become adopted in our everyday world. So again, the idea that the dreaming consciousness, or whatever you want to call it, is more enlightened than we are, right? So that, and which also I want to add too, why nightmares are so great, because nightmares are like the natural disasters. They're breaking open our landscape to return balance. You know, it seems like a bad thing happening, but it's actually very good because power has been hidden away. And, you know, so nightmare dreams are actually a good thing. So when you talk about lucid dreaming is where, you know, and I see this a lot when somebody accomplishes something, a big success thing in life, they go to the next level, something happens, and they'll have a flying dream. It's very common. And that means that while you're dreaming, you wake up and it's like, oh my God, anything's possible. I can fly. And, you know, so let's just say that lucid dreaming, there's a sense of consciousness coming into play into the dreamscape. And what do? We start to control it. So in my opinion, lucid dreaming, while it can be a great creative tool, it can be a, you know, it's like doing a drug. How can you say that? How can you say ayahuasca may not be beneficial? Or, you know, like obviously consciousness expanding, that's all great. But when it comes to dreaming, I don't know that lucid dreaming would be the next evolution of where dreaming has taken us, because it's better to be in the state where parts of your mind are shut down, so that you can really open to the possibilities.
Wow, I've never heard it approached that way, and I really appreciate that. You know, because
it would be like,
you know, it just shows humanity. Be like, nope, I still need control. That dreams,
yeah,
no,
exactly.
No, give me
exactly,
that handlebars.
You know? And it's kind of like, you know, I mean, I work with that, with the operating system a lot. Like I know the code, and so I might have a different idea of it, but it doesn't mean that somebody can't come along with AI and say it's the greatest thing in the world, or, you know, like everybody has their input. And it, you know, but for me, dreaming is kind of, there's a reason that we don't remember, or there's a reason that we're not conscious, just like we wouldn't want to wake up in an operation, or, you know, like, you know what I mean?
I do, yes, exactly. All of a sudden you wake up and the scalpel's going through your chest.
Like,
no.
Just
put me back out.
Even though it would have healed us to allow it to happen, right? We would immediately want to stop it.
Yeah.
You know?
I appreciate that. That's a great perspective, you know. And that's why I love talking to people that have different perspectives than me, because, you know, like, we can't think of everything, and sometimes we just get so caught in our stories about, like, oh, I can't even fucking dream right, you know.
And that's what's so cool about podcasts, and kudos to you, you know, to do that, because it's such a great way to keep the discussion going, you know, like there's so much that we don't know, and it's so, you know, we learn from each other, and
that's the best way
so,
to do
yeah.
it.
Yeah, no, and I really appreciate, you know, where you're, I love your ideas, and
thank you. Well, I wanted to talk about your work with the Tao and the I Ching, and the translations that you've done with those two beautiful writings. Those have both been very influential in my life, in the path that I've had. Stephen Mitchell's, you know, translation of the Tao is probably one of the more popular ones that I've read. I've got yours on my list, and I, you know, I haven't gotten to the I Ching generator that you have on your website yet, but there is a free I Ching generator that, if I'm not mistaken, it's the number one in the world.
Yep.
That's
Isn't
amazing.
That crazy?
That's freaking
that's
amazing.
Crazy. I know, that's crazy.
Congratulations.
But I love it. People write me, and it makes me feel good when people say, you really have a great way of describing, because it can, you know, a lot of interpretations can, you know, seem very like, doesn't make sense, you know, the I Ching, but anyway.
Yep. And it's hard to sometimes take the metaphors of, you know, thousands of years ago and place them into now times and to understand how they land or how they overlap.
Well, I had spent so much time with all of the, I mean, I have a collection of ancient Chinese philosophy that I'm sure somebody would love to have. Like I collected it all. And I feel like I was so much studying a lot of these ideas before I approached the Tao Te Ching or the I Ching, so that it was like, whoa, this is Wong Tzu was saying that, or this is Mun Tzu, or this is Kung Fu Tzu, or you could kind of see, even like, though they say the Tao Te Ching was written by one person, Lao Tzu, I don't think so, because you can tell just the way it's put together. There's it's like there was this version of this one idea, and it shows up in a later chapter saying the same idea, but kind of like almost like it was handed to a student, and this was the student's version of that same idea. Like we always say, the Tao Te Ching is like it's more of a book about what Tao isn't. And it's
Yes.
like poetry in the sense that it takes you spiritually and emotionally in these things that might feel like nonsense, but it takes you into kind of like a shift just by willingness to follow it,
Yeah.
like a poem would, right? So it's kind of but yeah, like so I, and that, and I applied a lot of, I saw it a lot in the I Ching too. In fact, my first book on the I Ching was actually called Nothing Bad Happens in Life, and I actually used the hexagrams from 1 to 64 as sort of a transformational path, and you could see how the I Ching was probably more of a philosophical study before it became an oracle.
I've used the I Ching so many times now to just help with questions in life, and I could see how it has that ability to be read like a book. It doesn't have to necessarily, you don't have to necessarily find the right kuah for you. With the with the hexagrams, you can kind of read through the different kuas and understand the messages and the lessons that are being taught there, even though a lot of times, whether it's the coins or the sticks that you're using to find the right one for you. And with the same with the Tao, every time I read the Tao, it's something else pops out at me. I'll spend about a month on one poem or one page. And then sometimes I'll read the whole thing in a week, and it's just everything. It's so beautiful how these things unlock as we're ready to find the ways to approach the information.
Yeah, and
And
it's so interesting that it was, when this beautiful ancient Chinese heritage was basically burned, and the books were all burned during the Communist Revolution, anything that would have appeared mystical, just like a lot of communist societies didn't really want religion or anything that would lead the masses into some sort of like hooply booply, but it was not, I mean, Confucianism stayed with them because it was about a person's proper role in society, but a lot of like the Meng Tzu and Wang Tzu and Lao Tzu and all the a lot of that stuff, what really didn't make itself into China's philosophical state of mind today, I guess is what I'm trying to say. It's kind of sad. It's a beautiful heritage, and anybody who really does kind of connect with it, and that's where a lot of my ideas. I'm sure that being the guest and not the host, I found that somewhere in one of those ancient books, or you know what I mean,
I
like that.
do.
Where and when I hear like a lot of the other writers out there, we're all kind of, really inspired by some of those ideas. And oh, this is my favorite part of Taoism, is and the I Ching, because the I Ching is like a hexagram of 6 lines, and it can only be an open or a closed line, and then if there's an old line or a new line, it can become a different hexagram. But Leibniz, a scientist, long, long ago, took one of the hexagrams. Like he was so blown away by how you can get a whole version of life described in the 64, hexagrams of the I Ching, because of just a yin and yang line, two things, one on, and he basically, turned one of the hexagrams sideways. And like started to see it as binary code that you could take that, does that make sense?
It
Like if he saw it
does.
visually, and he that is where binary code came from, on
Oh.
and off switches that became our technology today. The open is the yin and the closed is the yang. Open, close, open, close. And look at what it, like how it's become our world today,
Yeah.
right?
Oh my
Isn't
God.
that cool? I
That's
love that.
amazing. I never heard that before, and that makes so much sense. I mean, if you look at electricity, the voltage is measured in ohms. The ohm is the amount of energy that this thing holds, and ohm is the seed sound that we speak to find the energy of the world. So I just it's at that that makes me so happy to know. That makes me
And it's
so happy.
also electricity is also the yin and the yang, because you got the force and the field, and one can't exist without the other. It takes the field to pull the force. The force creates the field pulls the force. Boom, light goes from one place at the, 186,000 miles per second across the universe.
Wow.
What
Wow. I love that. That's
a
beautiful.
world.
It
What a
is.
world.
Well, I love the idea that you'd spoke about how the Tao was written by more than one human being. It wasn't just Lao Tzu, like it's rumored to.
It's a collection for sure, in
Most
my
definitely.
opinion.
Yeah. There's actually something I read recently about Shakespeare, and that William Shakespeare
I
is now.
heard that too.
Yeah, right. It's a collective of writers in that time frame that just penned it under Bill Shakespeare, and now we know that person to be this person that didn't really exist. So I don't know the validity of that. So don't quote me on that, but
I
those are
don't know.
stories that I've been
Yeah.
hearing now.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, if somebody was translating Shakespeare and started to see what I was kind of seeing, because I mean, really, like I was work when I have a translation of the Tao Te Ching, so it's kind of like when you start to see like you don't see it so much in Shakespeare that Hamlet could be anything like the Taming of the Shrew, or when you see kind of repetitiveness shortened, or then you kind of get the sense, well, that this can't couldn't have been by one person. They wouldn't have organized it that way.
Right.
And so I don't know that if that I honestly I'm not a big Shakespeare blah blah
Yeah,
blah.
same. Yeah, I've muscled my way through in high school and then I kind of left it there. I've seen
Yeah.
the recent adaptations, but I haven't really dove into Bill's work. So
Right.
well, with somebody that's approaching the I Ching, 'cause that excuse me, that's had so much of an impact in my life, but it's taken me so long to understand the process. And I've always used the sticks. I've not used the coins. And the process of sitting down and writing your intention, requestion, doing the sticks, finding the lines, the broken lines, the full lines, the dot lines, and so the whole process is it's beautifully interactive. And but it can be confusing and it can take some time and it can be something that in the beginning for me it was very frustrating and I left it alone for a while. And it's something I kind of dabble back into, but knowing that there's like a generator that I can put my information in and see have you basically transcribe and put into some more maybe more terms that are conditional towards what humanity is now, not breaking down all the metaphors. That's such a beautiful opportunity for humans to just have another layer of something that they can look towards, another divination tool. So with that, I mean, is that something that's a living kind of document with you? Is that something that you're
Ah, that's a
constantly like
great.
kind of going back and looking at and seeing how this new
No.
information comes in?
No, but I will tell you this. It doesn't feel, I mean, it feels like it has its own life. I mean, I felt that, because it was one thing to write the interpretation of the book. It's called The Essential I Ching, but it's based on what's in the website. But I gave so much care to the development of the technology, to the chance factor of whether it's an open, closed, old yin, old yang, the things that you might use gyro stocks or throw coins or whatever, the odds of getting this, I gave a lot of consideration to that. And then as the interpretations went into it, and now you basically go and you click a button 6 times and you get either lines that aren't changing, where you get a static reading, or you get maybe one or two lines changing, and then you get, the second hexagram. I can't, and people write and tell me this too, like they're blown away at how it feels, very like how could it know? And I do, I feel like it's something that I created, but it has just a life of its own, and it's doing what it wants to do, and I feel like I respected the process enough that it was built right. Is that a weird thing to say? But
Nope.
so I kind of, and I love, I mean, I do feel like my website is kind of a light left on out there for anybody that is like, kind of struggling or wants to start an inner dialogue about possibilities for, connecting with their authenticity, which is that, one thing too that I love about Taoism is in most, approaches, they would say the development of virtue is so important. Like to be in society, you have to be virtuous, and these are the virtues. And, in Taoism, there's a story about these characters being at somebody's funeral, sitting in the back laughing, Taoists, and they're like, how inappropriate, or blah, blah, blah. But there is no inappropriate behavior, or there are no, It's better to be authentic than virtuous
I love that.
in Taoism. And so that whole process of opening yourself to amaze yourself by your openness. I don't know if that may even makes sense,
It
but
does.
to just be that open that you're constantly,
Yeah. Well, and that's something that's drawn me to Taoism over and over again, and not away from Buddhism or Confucianism, but more towards the relation to Taoism. And that there's a painting that I found a number of years ago called The Vinegar Tasters. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it.
No.
So it's an old painting that's been recreated many, many times. It's thousands of years old. I actually have a tattoo of one of the depictions of it, but it's basically Lao Tzu, Confucius, and Buddha standing around a vat of vinegar. And they're each dipping their pinky finger in this vat of vinegar. And each one of them has a different look on their face, but they're very similar, right? They look
It's
very
sour.
exactly right. So
I
Confucius has
love
the
that.
sour look on his face because, deviating from the ritual path makes, Confucius sour. Buddha has more of a bitter look on his face because in society we understand that personal, we have the pursuits of life, and that can sometimes lead to bitterness, but there's this overarching, happiness we're looking for. And then, but in Lao Tzu's face, it's more of a neutral, happy look. And again, they're all very, very similar, just minute differences. But, in Lao Tzu and in Taoism, they talk about happiness and finding that middle path and the harmony. And so, like to that point you just made, it's like, yeah, laugh in the back of a funeral, that's the
Right,
middle path for
exactly.
you, and
It's
that's.
that simple. Like it just be and stop being focused on what you might become and be in the beingness of who you are.
Yeah. And that's so hard sometimes, because
I know.
we're taught to pattern, that our brain's a pattern making machine. And when we see a human acting a certain way, there might be something subconscious being like, well, shit, I'm not acting that way. I need to match that energy level, whether it's raising or lowering my personal
Which
energy.
brings up kind of another idea that gets sort of mixed up. Like, first of all, like Buddhism is really the combination of Taoism and Hinduism that sort of evolved into Buddhism. So it's kind of like Taoism kind of is a little bit older, but there's an idea called Wu Wei, Wuwei, and the idea of not doing that you see a lot in different. In some places in Buddhism, it might be meditation, stillness, negating Maya, the outer world as being an illusion. In Taoism, the idea of Wu Wei, it's a very fascinating thing to study because it, like where can you be at that hovering at the doorway of perception and, and still be a productive person in life, right? Like you can't just stop, but the idea of Wu Wei is to not push, not orchestrate, again, be the guest, not the host. So you can still be successful and powerful and, all the things that society, would recognize as somebody who made profound changes or, you can still be all of that. But follow, like allow, like it's almost like a blossoming rather than pushing your way into the world or whatever. So I love that idea of Wu Wei is not doing, not taking any course of action that's going against the flow. Meaning, like you said, whatever was going on with you when you were getting on your computer and what the new download of
Yeah, the
Zoom.
updates wouldn't work.
Exactly. Where, Tim is sort of like, maybe there's a sense of composure, like, and going with the flow so that we could have such a wonderful discussion, same thing with me. I jumped on Zoom and I got the download too. And I was like, good thing I was early. Isn't that amazing?
There's a philosophy I heard recently about just everybody's got different ways to look at life, and I was listening to this business person talk about life, and they were breaking it down into two different ways that obviously we can look at life many different ways, but this person was saying like if we have like a goal in mind, right? Let's say this podcast that I started a couple of years back, I can look at it like a construction site. Like I can have a blueprint of what I want. I can put the wall here, the foundation, the windows, I know where everything's going. I'm physically manually putting this in there. I'm growing it, in a physical way. Or you can have a garden, right? Where you have this beautiful soil and you plant a seed. right? It's not a forest. You don't just throw seeds in the forest and walk away and hope for the best. You have this beautiful soil. You put the seeds in there, and then you provide all the thing that needs for that seed to grow. Fertilizer, water, light, all that
and
stuff.
And that's where life shows it's us why we should live in wonder.
Yeah.
Because what pops up is nothing that you could have expected.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Even if it's a flower, you know, what it. So it's kind of like, I love that idea for your podcast as being a garden.
And it helped. It actually released a lot of anxiety, you know, because my previous life, I was a corporate person. I have ROIs and all these acronyms and all this shit that's in my head that I feel like I need to hit and growth and all this stuff, right? And the garden concept to me, just like you said, it just allows me to go with the flow. Yes, I'm still tending to it, right? I can prune it. Mm-hmm. I can add more water. I can change the way it's facing, but it's still going to grow the way it's supposed to, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm just there to observe and to be witness to it and to, you know, accept that growth and integrate that growth into my life in the way that I feel that it'll best help both
and
me all, and the
also
growth.
And also the being the guest part where you can't control what's going to come out of that ground. You can give it all the water and da 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 da, you know, like, when it's going to grow, it's going to grow, and it's going to grow into what it is. You know what I mean? Like, it's also kind of a good metaphor for not being, you can't make it go faster. You can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause if you add too much fertilizer, it'll grow all weird and stuff. So it's, right. It is that practice of trusting that, you know, you're putting the right effort forward that you feel proud of, that you feel honored, and that you are loving the thing that is going to birth itself in front of you, however it's going to birth itself.
Because it makes me laugh, because it's like I moved to a different part of California where it's much more rugged. Like, there's a lot of really wild animals where I live. Like, mm-hmm. I hear mountain lions yelling mating calls at night. Ooh. I think I'm in Africa. But, you know, but you know, I did try when I first got there to plant a few things, and you can't do that because, like, the deer come and they eat it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it's like pretty soon you just get used to, like, the things like poppies are growing like crazy. The wild poppies are the things that want to be there, you know. So it's just kind of funny because we're talking about the garden, and it's like, even when you do everything right, then a deer comes and eats it. It's like, okay, I'm not in control.
Yeah, uh-huh, exactly. I've just planted a salad bar for the animals. That's great.
Exactly. I tried a Japanese maple up there. Oh my God, they ate it down to a twig.
Oh, Jesus.
I know, it was horrible. But anyway, everybody's okay. And, but you just can't control the outcome.
Yep, exactly. And the more we try to, the more frustrating we're going to get.
Right.
Definitely. Well, so Carrie, what else, what else is on the horizon for you, right? Are you working on more books? Are you, I know you're doing a lot of speaking right now. So, like, what are these next kind of chapters in your life looking like?
Well, when a book comes to me, it comes like I'm going to give birth. Like, it comes for beginning, middle, end. Like, and I'll have it for, you know, so I haven't really had that sensation about anything. I mean, I've kind of, you know, I'm also a musician, so I'm always kind of going back and forth between the inspiration that comes as, you know, the music or the writing or whatever it is. So I'm kind of like, I guess, and just more in a state of, and of course I just went through this with my mother. So it'll take a little time for, you know, that kind of to shift into kind of a different energy. Mm-hmm. But I guess right now in my life, I'm just very accepting, more in like a state of practicing, like doing a lot of mountain hiking and kind of, you know, I'm not really looking to write anything right now, but if it comes, I'll know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Kind of thing.
But I love really the metaphor you just had of birthing, you know, and that's a lot
it
of
is
that
birthing.
It feels that, you know, you get that idea, you get that impregnation of like, oh shit, like I have something. It's like that antenna that's up, you know, just catches that right frequency that only you can translate, you know, and it's
exactly
like, cool, all right, here we go.
And it's not even like it's a choice. Like, I get so, I can't, you know, then all of a sudden it has its own life, whatever it was. It just came through me, you know, like it's totally like birthing.
Wow.
And until, you know, I kind of get that, you know, thing going, I'm just sort of like in a place between, I guess it would be sort of like music as a, I don't want to do more music right now. I have like stuff that's for meditation and stuff, but this would be more of like understanding the role music has in Anyway, that's kind of just something I've been exploring.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I think there's, I mean, there's so much that music has done for me personally, with sound healing and just been, it's something that's been very present in my life. I just didn't really know, how to approach it or what to really do with that knowledge until I got sound bowls in a gong, and I'm like, okay, cool. I guess this is why I know all this weird stuff about music that I've never figured out before. It's to make, healing music for people to find their path with. Yeah.
And also music, like just in mainstream, like why was 1971 so prolific? I know
Yeah.
that's, no, I mean like every there's so much stuff that's like timeless that came out of that one year. So, but like, and then, it's happened probably in the nine, pieces of the 90s that to totally transforms. And I guess looking at it more of like the zeitgeist,
Yeah.
the whole like vibe of music as sort of the zeitgeist of the time.
Yeah. I love that, because the 90s, I grew up in the 90s, or my main, I guess, influential teenage years in the 90s.
What
And
was
I,
that,
so,
Nirvana?
yeah, Nirvana, but I
Nirvana.
was, the Pearl Jams, the grunge scene. But, for me, I was more of a hip hop kid. I loved underground hip hop. And, but the music in the 90s, like I thought for the longest time, I just had nostalgia around it. Like it was just nostalgic to me. And I just, it was those things that make me feel good because it was stuff, with simpler times. But now, like as my kids are getting older and
They're
discovering
liking
music, they
it.
love it. They're all
I
like all
know.
these kids that I know that are in their teens and preteens, they're all going to like late 90s, early 2000s for rock, hip hop, whatever it is. And so there is just something in me of like, man, maybe there was something special about that decade of music, just like 1971. That so there's these times when like these messages have to be gotten out there, and this angst has to be addressed, and these political things have to be talked about in some kind of way outside of watching CNN or hearing, political banter on TV and all this bullshit. Sometimes music can speak directly to the person and understand
Or
that.
just sort of like mesmerize and guide, like some sort of birthing on like a on a large level, like what you would, zeitgeist kind of energy of like, yeah, because we need something right now. It's so crazy out there,
Yes, it is.
with just in the media world, let's say.
Yeah.
There's so much information and it's so heavy.
Which I think, really helps with that idea of the middle ground. How can you absorb the information without getting overtaken by it? Because it's good to know what's out there, whether or not you prescribe to it or not, that's fine, but I'm a big fan of the idea of, get outside of your comfort zone, get outside of your echo chamber, find, differing views of what you might have to see just how it lands. And I think that's where the beauty of something that can come through in music can really do, because it can kind of disguise it under maybe a catchy tune or a nice guitar riff or something like that.
Even music without words, like just the whole vibe of like, how it's transformed, rock to, disco to, synthesized, how it just the technology that's available and the whole, and then, like I do a lot of my music, I use ethnic drums. I mix a lot of hip hop kind of stuff into
Okay.
it,
All
and
right. Looks like I got some music to check out from you now.
so.
Well, Gary, thank you so much for joining me. I'm so excited for your path and for the content that you put out there, and to continue to dive into what you've offered this world outside of, what we just talked about. And to
You're
see,
so
just
sweet. You don't
oh.
have to say all that, but thank you. You've been a pleasure to talk to as well. I love what you're doing, and I wish you a lot of success.
Thank you so much. And right back at you. And if I can do anything to help you on your journey, please let me know. I'd love to have you back on.
Ditto.
All right. Thank you so much, Gary. Thank you so much for spending time with Carrie and I. Please check out the show notes for ways to get in touch with Carrie, to visit her website, Cafe au Sol, and to maybe look at some of the books and the offerings that she has outside of what we talked about. Obeisance and love. We'll see you next time.